I'm Jeff Sickinga, Executive Director of the Ashbrook Center, and this is The American Idea, where we discuss the ideas, people, and events that have made America what it is today. We believe that by understanding our history and our principles, we can better live up to the promise of the American founding and preserve our ongoing experiment in self-government. Welcome to The American Idea.
I want to welcome everyone to this episode of The American Idea. Today, we're going to be talking about something you all have heard about, but maybe don't understand what they are or why they are so important for American public life and the American economy. The conversation today is going to be about capital markets, and we are delighted to be joined for that conversation by Robert Salvaggio. Bob is co-owner and president, head of analytics at Rudder Associates. They provide advisory services in the areas of market and credit. Before that, he was for a number of years at Chase Manhattan Bank as a managing director. So this is a person who has spent his life in financial services and analyzing capital markets and credit, received his bachelor's degree from the University of Pennsylvania, his PhD in economics from Brown University. So he knows the academic side. And he knows the practical side, the real world side. And I also have to tell our listeners, I'm not going to mess with him because he's a fifth Dan master and sparring instructor in Taekwondo. So all my questions are going to be really nice today, Bob.
If you want to do some verbal martial arts, that's okay, Jeff. I'll find it.
Let's have a conversation and not do too much sparring. capital markets. All right. It's a phrase that we hear in the news every day. If you turn on CNBC, if you turn on Fox Business, if you just pick up the Wall Street Journal or anything out there, you hear some conversation about capital markets. But I think it's really true. We have a lot of listeners to this podcast who are very informed citizens and who are historically minded and know that these things are somehow important, but we may not know what exactly they are and why they're important. Can we just start with simple, what are capital markets?
Capital markets are first markets, okay? So a market is basically a place where something is exchanged. In the labor market, we have suppliers of labor, you and I, who are working for somebody, and those who demand our labor, folks for whom we're working. It's the labor market. In the goods market, I go to the store, I buy things. I log on to Amazon.com. My wife does that a lot more than I do. And we buy things. Amazon sells us things. So you've got supply and demand. We're on the demand side, and the store owners and the producers are on the supply side. It's not much different in the capital markets. We hear a lot, as you mentioned, you don't have to pick up the Wall Street Journal, you can pick up any local tabloid newspaper, and they're going to talk about where the S&P closed yesterday. They're going to talk about the Dow Jones. They're going to talk about Treasury interest rates. Where's the 10-year? That's been a big number. Where's the Fed funds rate? This is all involved with capital markets, and it all has to do with the supply and demand for funds. So basically, you've got these three markets. You've got supply and demand for goods in the goods market, supply and demand for labor in the labor market, and supply and demand for funds in the capital markets.
All right. Can I follow up on that a little bit?
Sure.
All right. I think some of our listeners are saying, okay, now that's a very clear, really nice explanation of capital markets, buying and selling of funds, essentially. How is capital in the United States sold? How is there buying and selling a market for capital?
Oh, well, an entrepreneur decides he wants to take his company public. What is he going to do? He's going to sell. He may sell shares. He may go to the equity market, the stock market, which we refer to as the equity market. He'll go to the equity market and he'll sell shares in his company. Those shares are ownership. You or I or anybody who's interested in investing and hoping making some money may see the prospects for this company being very good. Earnings look like they're going to be good. It looks like the dividend stream is going to be healthy. We get excited about this. So what do? We put down our money and we buy those shares. So we are supplying funding to this company by buying its shares. Now, once we do that, right? So once we buy those shares, and I'll just talk a moment about the equity market. Once we buy those shares, we're free then to go and buy and sell them in the open market. The company with whom we originally transacted to buy those shares at their initial offering is not part of that anymore. At that point, we can buy and sell those shares in the open market. If we've made enough money, we feel like we've earned a nice return on those shares, we're going to sell those shares to somebody else, some anonymous person in the stock market who thinks that they have good prospects for that company. They want to buy those shares. If we've lost money on those shares and we don't see prospects, we're going to do the same thing. We may well sell. And that's equity. And equity is ownership. So we've actually purchased ownership in a company.
I think a lot of people hear that and say, okay, so yeah, all right. That means if I have a 401k, for example, and I'm invested in stocks, I'm in the capital markets.
You are in the capital markets.
Okay. So I think a lot of folks listening might think, well, this is obviously a product of modern economic conditions. This is a 2025 thing this must have started in the 1970s or 80s. Have there been capital markets in the United States for a long time?
Oh, stock companies were here at the earliest exploration or earliest settlements of the Europeans into North America. Absolutely. Absolutely. And go way back before that. So this is not a new innovation by any means. And it's really the capital markets are so basic to our capitalist economy. The free flow of funds from investors to the ultimate users of those funds is what's going to allow for the efficient operations of the economy. So capital, whether it's stock, bonds, debt, we can talk about that as well, but those funds are going to go to where the economy or people in the economy, the average economy, where shareholders or creditors think is the best use, was going to be the most productive, most profitable use of those funds. So it's really just so important to our economy.
And so that means there have been really important moments in American history, I would presume. I'm thinking, for example, the crash of 1929 in the markets and its connection to the Great Depression. So there have been moments in American history that have been, if I'm understanding what you're saying, that really have been in some ways driven by either the success or the failure, if we could call it that, of capital markets.
Well, that's part of it. In some sense, the capital markets are going to also respond to what's going on in the real economy. So macroeconomic events are going to drive the capital markets. And of course, there could be a bit of a feedback loop. Macroeconomic events can drive the capital markets, and then the capital markets can have a feedback effect on the real economy. And we saw some of that during the Great Depression. Although, I mean, there are differing theories of what drove the Great Depression.
Right. How about in more modern times then? When the sorts of very highly technical, complex transactions that have taken place in capital markets, because capital markets are no longer just me through my 401k buying stock. There's an enormous range of buying and selling of capital back and forth. When did we start to see that kind of complexity? And can you tell us a little bit more about that complexity?
Well, let's first, so there's equity, there's stock. You can buy stock, you can buy and sell stock. Companies don't only issue stock. Another way of raising capital is through debt. So they borrow money. So investors will buy bonds. Institutional investors and retail investors will buy bonds. And that way the company is actually indebted and they're creating what's called leverage for the shareholders, meaning that they're borrowing money and hoping to earn even a higher return on their equity investments. Where things get complicated is when structures are developed in order to perhaps increase leverage beyond where but beyond where informed investors should be operating. And we've seen that in recent years. We've seen the use of derivative products that may be inappropriate. We've seen where the capital markets may have gone wrong in terms of mortgage lending before the Great Recession, between 2003 and 2006, probably the capital markets enabled mortgage lending at rates that were unsustainable and rates that were not correct, improper credit analysis in terms of the rates and what was offered to borrowers. We saw derivatives and other types of structures, such as, I don't get too complicated, but there are structures that involved packaging pieces of subprime mortgages into a large bucket. So a company would go out and buy pieces of subprime mortgages, very low rated pieces of subprime mortgages, put it into one structure, and then sell off pieces of that structure and create what they thought was a AAA. AAA is the highest credit quality that a credit rating agency would award. What they would call a AAA piece of this structure. So a piece that maybe only takes the last 30% of losses. A structure has to lose 60% before even a dollar would get lost in that piece that sold off. The problem, of course, is all these bad mortgages went bad. Not 60%, all of them. So we saw investors getting totally wiped out in these AAA.
Can we talk a little bit more about that? Because I think that's an interesting point of the that sort of, as you were saying, an interesting moment for capital markets that I think is probably fresh for at least a lot of our listeners. Sure. Would be, you know, late 2000s, 2008, 2009. Right. Can you tell us a little bit more about what was happening then that led to that kind of correction and recession?
So because of the ease of credit, housing prices were driven by the summer of 2006 to totally unsustainable levels.
Yeah, I mean, I can just say my wife and I built our house and bought our house in May of 2003. And we got an interest rate that floored my dad, who got his house in 1963. He thought he had a great rate at 4%, and we got 2.75% interest rate.
Yeah, but you were probably a creditworthy borrower.
I'd like to think so. At least my wife is. So what happened? We had very low interest rates. And then what happened?
We had very low interest rates. We had mortgage lenders that went down credit. We had Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac that also went down credit. They didn't often use the word subprime. So many, they had different euphemisms for the word subprime. So many didn't know what they were doing. So they basically stoked a fire and created a bubble, a real estate bubble. And that bubble, shortly after summer of 2006, that bubble burst. And it was really recognized first by a couple of infamous structured products created by Bear Stearns. And those products failed. Bear Stearns failed shortly thereafter. We saw in September 2008, we saw September 15th, 1 a.m., we saw Lehman fail. The next day, AIG, one of the top insurance companies in the country, was declared insolvent and was basically taken over by the U.S. government. And the rest was history. But here's what happened. Partly because of these products that were demanding so much mortgage paper, buying these mortgages after they were created, because there was such a demand for this product, it drove the yields on mortgages down, and the mortgages were being offered to inappropriate borrowers. So if you read about that period, you're going to hear about Alt-A mortgages, you're going to read about subprime mortgages, and obviously, some very smart people made a lot of money recognizing what was going on.
Before we continue with our conversation,
I'd like to have one of our faculty members tell you about a special documents-based graduate program for teachers of American history, government, and civics.
Hi, this is John Moser, chair of the Master of Arts in American History and Government program at Ashland University. If you are an educator who teaches U.S. history, government, or politics, our program may be just what you've been looking for. Our approach is to emphasize primary sources, since we think the best way to study the past is to read the words of those who lived it. We have a distinguished faculty made up of professors from both Ashland University and from colleges and universities across the country. And they're not there to lecture to you. We think it's better to learn through conversation about the documents. Ours is a hybrid program with two different types of seminar. The first are our week-long intensive in-person courses during the summers on the beautiful campus of Ashland University. The second are our live synchronous online seminars offered throughout the year. So if you're a social studies teacher and you're looking to deepen your understanding of America's past and its politics, please check out the Master of Arts in American History and Government program. You can do that by visiting tah.org/programs.
And I think a number of our listeners who remember that time historically say, all right, have capital markets learned from that? Has our economics, but also perhaps our politics, learned from that, the right lessons?
There was a professor, and I can't remember, I think it was at University of Oklahoma, Rufus Fears, who said, the first lesson of history is that no one learns from history.
And it's sad, but often true.
Yeah. And I would say, oh, and actually, believe it or not, I think Bill McClay actually succeeded him in that chair, and Rufus Fears in that chair. But I would say that applies double to economic and financial history. So, I'm part of what my business does is we help firms or we review their risk management methodologies and techniques and procedure policies and procedures just to make sure and just to help them avoid that the next disaster that's inevitably going to come.
Because you think that capital markets have not learned the lessons that they ought to have learned from 08-09.
Well, capital market participants have not fully learned those lessons, because there's always this hubris to believe that it can't happen to me or it can't happen again.
I see. So
think about what's going on right now with the federal budget, with our debt.
Right. And it's on its way toward what, $40 trillion national
right.
debt.
So who's learning? I mean, this is leverage. This is leverage, and leverage is what killed during the financial crisis. And this is what's coming down the pike. This type of a disaster, it's inevitable.
So, in fact, you hear about this in the news. Of course, the enormous federal budget deficit, but then the national debt growing.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think some of our listeners would be very interested to understand a little bit more about the role of capital markets in funding the federal deficit and the national debt.
So the Treasury issues bonds. Well, they issue Treasury bills, which have maturities up to 1 year. They issue Treasury notes that have maturities from 1 year to 10 year. And then they issue bonds that have maturities beyond 10 years. And that's how the federal government borrows. The nice thing about for us as investors, we typically are going to have some Treasuries in our portfolio. The yields lately have been pretty generous. We don't pay state taxes on Treasury issuances. And they are traditionally looked at and still looked at as a flight to quality. So our credit rating, the United States debt credit rating, is no longer AAA. It's S&P has it AA plus. Fitch has it AA plus, and Moody's has it AA1. All the same. And there may be a handful of U.S. corporations that still have AAA rating, but AAA rating is very rare. But we're still looked at as a flight to quality, as the safest still refer to treasury debt as the risk-free investment. And probably for most of us of a certain age, it is a risk-free investment. I don't know about our children, grandchildren, but for most of us that have a certain age, it is the risk-free investment. So that's how the treasury, that's how the government funds itself through treasury issuances. What we need to be careful of, and this is something that's very much in the news today, but in a different sense, we have to be careful of the Federal Reserve, the monetary authorities, buying all the treasury debt or buying too much of the treasury debt. Because what we do not want is we do not want any threat to the independence of the Treasury and the Federal Reserve. Now, today, the issue is we're a little worried about the president jawboning at the moment the Fed to lower the federal funds rate. Federal funds rate, very important. Federal funds rate is the base rate. Fundamentally, the base rate for most lending in this country, certainly most commercial lending in this country. So to the extent that rate goes down, funds become cheaper for firms who are looking to borrow.
That's an interesting, I'm thinking about the relationship between the federal deficit and debt and capital markets. On the one hand, capital markets, as you say, fund the federal debt by buying these treasury notes and bills and notes and bonds. On the other hand, what effect does the federal deficit and national debt have on capital markets?
It's interesting. There have been so many studies about that a high level of deficits would cause higher interest rates because government borrowing will crowd out private borrowing. And it's been a mixed bag. It's actually been a mixed bag. There is no established conclusion about the impact of budget deficits on interest rates.
That's interesting. Yeah, intuitively you would think it would, but there must be other factors at work that countervail that.
Part of it is there's still a great amount of international demand for U.S. Treasury bills, notes, and bonds. So you know that demand is very, very large. Wealthy individuals and institutions in countries that have to worry about, you know, perhaps state confiscation of their assets will invest in U.S. treasuries. They'll also invest in extremely expensive property in London and New York, where they never visit.
Right. Right. that's very interesting. So really, in some ways, we're not seeing the economic effects on capital markets of deficits because we have these foreign buyers who still to this day think of the United States as a safe credit risk.
I do believe that that has to be the outlet.
What is happening today? Now, I think a lot of our folks are thinking about the economic uncertainty of the situation today in 2025, economic uncertainty, the economy contracted, it seemed like, in the first quarter, or at least didn't grow much. Mm-hmm. And people are wondering, is a recession on the way? What's the state of capital markets today?
Well, the capital markets do not seem concerned about a recession. And clearly, the gauge that we look at most closely for those sort of signals would be the S&P 500, and we're at record highs right now for the S&P 500. You see some wiggles day to day when there's different talk about the tariffs, but overall, the capital markets themselves are not signaling a major fear of an imminent recession. However, that's not to say that economists are that sanguine about it. I think we're seeing on average probably about a 30 to 40% probability of recession amongst economists over the next 2 years. Recessions happen every few years. So
That's what I was going to ask you, because there does seem to be people talk about a business cycle,
right?
That old phrase.
Right.
And people sort of say, well, yeah, you have periods of growth, and then you have some periods of slowdown or retraction, and then another period of growth. Are we in that? Is that a reasonable way of looking at American economic situation given the past, or is this, are we, is that not no longer kind of the right way to look at things?
Yeah, I don't think so. I mean, I don't think there really is a business cycle. I think you do see periods of contraction, and you do see periods of expansion. You do see recessions, and you do see booms. But typically, my view is recessions really are caused by something, some sort of a shock. Look, the last two we saw obviously were caught. The first was caused by the mortgage meltdown, and the second one we saw since then was caused by the pandemic. And that one obviously did it last 2 months? I don't recall. It was the shortest recession in history.
Right, right.
But again, most recessions are caused by an event, by what we call, economists would call, an exogenous event, something outside of the economy. The economy doesn't seem to just sputter out on its own.
Now that we've had some opportunity, as you say, to learn something from the 2008-2009 situation and from our contemporary situation, you can't wave a magic wand. I know that, but if you could give us your thoughts on, are there any reforms in the way that government and the law interact with capital markets that you think would be helpful for American economic prosperity, or for just the proper working of capital markets?
Yeah, I mean, we did see a few reforms, obviously, after the financial crisis. The Volcker Rule about trading in large banking institutions, I think, was important. Even some of the Dodd-Frank types of reforms, although I always thought that having either of those on that bill was ridiculous, because they both have blood on their hands for stoking the great financial crisis and, you know, the sort of the mortgage crisis in general. But I think that they have made a difference, at least in the United States. On the retail level, derivatives cannot, highly levered derivative products, exotic financial products in the capital markets are excluded from retail investors. Not the same in Asia, not the same in many parts of the world. I think that's important. I think there are those sorts of protections to keep less informed investors safe. I think that's important. In general, though, I think that, you know, we want to keep the flow of capital as free as possible, just as we want to keep the flow of goods and the flow of labor as free as possible. There's really that... You really don't want to hinder capital going to its most useful, most efficient places of use. That's the key.
Then what do you see? I'm always cautious to ask an economist to make a prediction. What's that old Harry Truman saying? Someone get me a one-armed economist.
Right.
Not on the one hand this, on the other hand that. Exactly. But your thought on for the over the horizon, let's say 5 years or so. Right. What's your thought on the direction of U.S. capital markets?
I'm worried more about our goods market, to tell you the truth. I'm worried more about exports and imports at the moment.
Okay. Interesting.
In terms of the capital markets, we have a very, very well developed capital market in this country. Our capital markets are very well developed. We could see shocks. We saw the stock market fall over 20% just a few months ago, and now it's up maybe 25. Well, it's got to be up more than 25% from that. The movements. Interest rates are going to change, stock prices are going to change, volatility in the market is going to change. Anything that I would anticipate would be a shock, and I can't anticipate a shock. So goodness knows what kind of a monkey wrench could be thrown into the machinery. What are the type of monkey wrenches that we've seen in the past? I mean, Mideast war, oil crisis, OPEC. Those are the sorts of things pandemic, the mortgage bubble. Those are the sort of things that can throw monkey wrenches into things. I worry, of course, about when you look at crypto and what's driving Bitcoin. But it doesn't matter because there aren't enough people involved in Bitcoin that a crash in that market or in Ethereum or any of those markets would cause a problem to the capital markets. I don't see any bubbles right now that are inflating. Robert Shiller at Yale, if anybody's interested, is the guy who does all the best writing on bubbles. He can arguably take credit for predicting the burst of the dot-com bubble in 2000, 2001, and the burst of the mortgage bubble in 2008. But I don't see any percolating bubbles. So we have a very well-functioning capital markets capital market system in this country. You know, again, I worry about some members of Congress who really don't agree with, who really don't like the capital markets, who really believe that they're just casinos where the rich take advantage of the poor, or the more informed take advantage of the less informed. And I'm not going to mention any names, but we see that every day.
Well, that's a helpful reminder, reassuring, but also a helpful reminder of things to be watching out for. Thank you for helping us to kind of unveil a little bit of the mystery of capital markets, their importance in American history, their importance today, and possibly their future importance. Bob Salvaggio, thanks for taking the time to join us on The American Idea.
Nice being with you, Jeff.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The American Idea. If you enjoyed this episode, remember to subscribe at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, and leave a 5-star review. If you want to learn more or get involved in Ashbrook's vital work, visit our website, ashbrook.org.